Good to be with you all. any easy questions?
Hi. So in your last question and answer here, you spoke about when you were doing metta, something nutty that you did was you kept checking in. And so the metta was about you. So two like easy questions, I think. First, the metta is kind of about you, isn't it? Because we're not trying to use like telepathy to change things. We're changing ourselves by using metta, right? Mm-hmm. And then how is checking in different from the third foundation of mindfulness, knowing whether the mind is concentrated or not?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just kind of referring back a little bit for those of you who came just for part two. I was talking about the time when I was practicing metta intensively in Burma, doing it as a concentration practice. And I began to notice in doing it that at certain points I was really more concerned with how concentrated I was becoming and assessing it and looking at it and judging it, even as I was repeating the phrases. You know, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, how am I doing? And the how am I doing became at some point more predominant than the actual metta wish for the other person. So you're correct in that the metta is transforming our own mind and heart and body. But that transformation happens from an extension of our loving wishes for the other person. And so if we're losing that, our mind might become more concentrated, just almost like repeating a mantra. But if our intention is to deepen the concentration on the feeling of metta itself, so we don't want to be undermining the strengthening of the metta by that self-assessment. What was the second one? Oh yeah. So when we're doing metta, that is not actually specifically an insight practice. Right. Well, but in doing a concentration practice, one wouldn't necessarily be investigating that third foundation, because the practice itself is having the mind stable and steady on the metta. So it's different than a mindfulness practice where we're looking at and assessing the quality of our concentration. And I don't mean to suggest kind of an absolute, you know, that we shouldn't be looking at all in terms of, okay, well, how's it going? Is the concentration deepening? But when that becomes the primary effort, then we're losing the connection with the feeling of loving kindness. So it's really a question of balancing the two. But I found it more helpful when I remembered that what I'm doing is wishing well for whoever the object was. You know, I just comment that I made last time. This is a sociological comment. Generally, men tend to ask questions quicker and faster than women. And so I just wanted to give space for women to ask questions. But last time, after I said that, no man asked another question. So I didn't mean to intimidate, but just to be aware of, you know, just making space so that anybody who wishes to ask has the space to do so. Okay, so you can... Over here, Greg.
Could you provide any tips on noting the three characteristics specifically in consciousness? I find with the other four aggregates, the three characteristics come up when concentration is there, but consciousness seems very consistent, very much me. Mm-hmm.
In terms of seeing the impermanence of consciousness, there are a couple of ways of doing it. One happens as the practice deepens and we begin to go through some of the different stages of insight. There is a stage that's called the stage of dissolution, where whatever we're looking at or whatever we're observing, we see is disappearing. So at that point, instead of the mind emphasizing the arising of new objects, or even the arising and passing, at that particular period in practice, the mind tends to see just the dissolving. At that stage, it becomes clear that, let me back up, even before that, we begin to have the insight that what's happening in each moment is knowing and an object arising and passing away. So knowing of a sight, knowing of a sound, knowing of a smell. And in fact, one of the earlier stages of insight is called purification of view. And that is the understanding, the insight, that really everything that we think of or call self or I, all that's really happening, moment after moment, is this pairwise progression, knowing an object, knowing an object, knowing an object, sight, knowing of its sound, knowing of its sensation, knowing of it. Right? And so that would be interesting for you just to investigate a bit. So this doesn't take, you know, super yogi status to do. It's just really looking to see, okay, in each moment, what's actually happening? There's an in-breath and the knowing of it, simultaneous. Okay, so that has already been seen. Then when we're in the stage of dissolution, where the mind is emphasizing or goes to seeing the disappearing of objects, having established the insight that all that's happening is knowing an object, then it becomes clear that the knowing also is disappearing in each moment. So that becomes clear at that time. There is another way of seeing the impermanence of consciousness. Years ago, I read a biography of Einstein, a really interesting book, and you know his theory. And one of the things that struck me was he was a theoretical physicist, and so most of his great, amazing understandings and discoveries came from thought experiments. Right? And so it highlighted for me the potential of using reflection or thought really as a vehicle of understanding and insight. And we don't talk so much about that in the context of Vipassana, but I began to use that as a vehicle in my own practice. And so, for example, the Buddha talked about what are the conditions for different sense consciousness to arise. How do we become conscious of seeing, conscious of hearing? And he said, this is really out of the Abhidhamma, there are four conditions for seeing consciousness to arise. We need an eye that's in working order. We need light. We need something coming in front of the eye. and we need attention. You know, so if you're absorbed in something else, something may cross your eye, but it won't register as seeing consciousness. So knowing this, knowing, okay, these four conditions give rise to seeing consciousness. So I was actually kind of just walking the loop, you know, and playing with this. And I asked myself, okay, these are the four conditions. What would happen? And I was seeing as I was reflecting on this. And then I asked myself the question, well, would this seeing consciousness be here if there was no I? This kind of I? Obviously not. Or would seeing consciousness be there if there was no light? And so just in the moment of that kind of, it's kind of a thought inquiry, you know, that's really, the thought is directing us to examine our experience. But just in that moment, for a moment, it really brought to life the conditioned, impermanent nature of consciousness. Because it's dependent on conditions. And if any one of the conditions is not there, then that consciousness is not going to arise. So it gave a very powerful experience of the impermanent nature of consciousness. And it's out of seeing the impermanence that we also begin to understand the selfless. That it doesn't belong to anybody. It just simply arises when the condition's there, and then the conditions change. So there's one other way, in terms of the characteristics. And this really goes to the to seeing the empty, selfless nature of consciousness. Okay, so there's a classic Zen story. Bodhidharma, who brought Buddhism from India to China. So he was living in his cave for 8 or 9 years, you know, facing the wall, deepening his enlightenment. Maybe you have to face the wall. Anyway. And then this yogi comes who was going to become his successor, but at this point he was just seeking, and he beseeched Bodhidharma to to help him, that he was in so much suffering. And there's a whole backstory to the interchange. But finally Bodhidharma comes out of his cave. What can I do for you? And this guy says, you know, my mind is suffering so much, please pacify it. And Bodhidharma says, well, show me your mind and I'll pacify it. And before I go on, this is going to sound like a Zen witticism, but it's not. It's actually a profound teaching. So don't give in to your impulse to just see it as some Dharma wit. It's actually saying something quite profound. So Bodhidharma says, show me your mind and I'll pacify it. And this person says, I've looked for it everywhere and I can't find it. And then Bodhidharma says, there, it's already pacified. So that, this is not really within the traditional teachings of Vipassana, but I found that this particular teaching has been very useful and powerful for me, incorporating it into the practice in this way. So we're sitting and maybe hearing is happening. Like now. Now we can hear sounds. So sometimes when I sit and I'll be hearing, then I will ask the question of myself, can I find what's knowing the sound? And I know I'm knowing it because I'm hearing. But can I find what it is that's knowing the sound? And then when I look, there's nothing to find. I've looked for it everywhere and I can't find it. So this points to kind of the mysterious union, you could say, of emptiness and awareness. There's nothing to find, and yet the knowing is still happening. And we may just... So just to ask that question, can I find what's knowing? Anything, a sound, a sight, a sensation. And then really to look, and that's a direct looking into the nature of awareness, the nature of knowing, and seeing that there is no thing to find. Yeah, and so we get a real hit or taste of, you could call it the emptiness of consciousness, or the insubstantiality, or the selflessness. There's nothing there to belong to anybody. And yet, the knowing is going on. Are we together? Or did I go off on some? I found it really interesting. You know, it is possible to overdo investigation, which I have a tendency to do, but it also is a powerful tool, just, you know, as you're doing the practice, so it's not, it's easy to get into kind of meditative, just habits, you know, our habitual way of doing the practice. And sometimes little things like this, whether it's understanding the conditioned nature of consciousness and take one condition away, doesn't arise, or looking for consciousness and seeing there's nothing to find, punctuating our regular practice with these kinds of investigation is very energizing and interesting.
I found consciousness is also very complicated thing to follow. So I was told knowing is always there. But according to what you just said, knowing is there only when the six sensor doors, one of us is there, the conditions support it, for example, the light, the air support the wave, and the attention is there. So can you further clarify what it means by knowing is always there? Thank you.
Okay, so first, different Buddhist traditions will explain it differently. So just so you know that. Within this tradition, that could be understood not that it's an unchanging phenomena that's always there, but rather that it's arising and passing in each moment. So that's what it's always there would mean in the context of this practice. So moment after moment, it's there depending on conditions, falls away, arising. Now this is according to the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, this arising and passing of consciousness is happening in the order of 17 trillion times a moment. So it's quick. And just, you know, if you think of, you know, if you had a flame, a torch, and you whirled it around like that, and you did it fast enough, you would see it as a circle. And you wouldn't be seeing the fact that it's actually a process. It would just look like something is there, steady state. But that's because the change is happening so quickly. So in the same way, it can often appear as if the consciousness or knowing is unchanging, steady state. But in this way of understanding it, it's really that it's arising and passing very, very quickly. But as I said, there are certain meditative experiences where we can begin to see the impermanence, the momentariness of it.
So if we continue what you just said, that consciousness rising, falling so frequently, then if there's no, if none of the six sense doors is open, does consciousness still rising, falling? I doubt it. For example, if we were sleeping and we have no dream, assuming dream is another thought, something coming. So sleeping has no first five sense doors and also have no thought. At that time, do we have a consciousness? Thank you.
Just to mention, this was supposed to be easy questions. But, so generally we think of the mind door in terms of our waking consciousness. Right? And so when you talk about the six sense doors being open, we think of it either as waking or dreaming, where there is some mental object. But actually, and again, this is all part of the psychological analysis and understanding that's in the Buddhist psychology. There is a quality or a function of mind, it's called, the Pali term is called Bhavanga consciousness. And we might think of it as, the way it's usually translated is life continuum consciousness. So there is a consciousness there even in deep sleep. Because if there weren't, probably wouldn't wake up. Yeah. So there is some process going on, even though we're not aware at that time, generally. There is a consciousness that is present. So you could think of it generally. I don't want to get too specific here, but maybe a Western term would be the unconscious mind or the subconscious mind, or you know, some process that's going on underneath the level of conscious mental activity. There are, as the meditation deepens, and there are some yogis who actually can be aware in deep sleep. You know, so that also is a potential. Jim.
Charles, I've given a lot of thought to how to put this question to you, and I've even questioned whether it is a question. I want your response to what's been a very, I hate the word to use the word profound, but a very deep experience for me here in this particular retreat. I read a book recently by someone who comes in, I don't know that you can narrow him down to coming from a Hindu perspective, but he certainly is very familiar in his practice Vipassana. This business about consciousness and just what it means and just how big a deal is it is kind of like not a small item, as you know. I have assumed and have practiced to the extent that I could along the way for almost 18 years since one of my first interviews with you, the crucial importance of anatta. And as I understand it, the Buddha was absolutely clear about there not being a consciousness that transcends from this place to this place to this place. I've never tried to work with that too hard, but one assumption that I could make is that, well, he's talking about my individual consciousness. Anything that can be identified as Jim, that ain't going anywhere once I die. But I've never assumed that didn't mean that what I do in this life, how I live my life, how I work out this particular dilemma didn't have consequences which were going to supersede my death. For instance, just as a brief example, the power of unconditional love. That's the one crucial thing in terms of me coming to what sense my whole life makes. I do believe in unconditional love. Mm-hmm. However badly that might be manifest and however well I may or may not respond to it, it's still there. Now I try to see things in terms of ego and what could be soul.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If you have thoughts about that in terms of what you think about the whole big question, please give them to me. But more importantly, in terms of practice and where I put my focus intent, I'm certainly not going to. Anatta is not up for grabs in this whole thing, is what I'm trying to tell you. Thanks.
Well, first, I think unconditional love is a good idea. I think it's hard to go wrong with that, you know. And as a guiding principle in one's life, you know, and on one's path. So again, different traditions, even within Buddhism, will really talk about this in different ways. So some traditions say that any kind of consciousness, no matter what, no matter how universal, any kind of consciousness at all is part of this process, this flow of arising and passing, but each moment is conditioning the next moment. And so the quality of consciousness developed in this life will carry over, but it's not the same. There's no thing which is carried over. It's this conditions this, conditions this, conditions this. So it's kind of like it's the example that's sometimes used. You know, if you put if you have a seal in wax, the seal will make an imprint in the wax. But there's nothing from the seal which is carried into the wax. It's rather that conditions the impression. So in the same way, each moment of consciousness is imprinting the next moment. But it's not carried over in any way. And so in this way of understanding, death consciousness, which is that last moment of consciousness before we die, is said to imprint the arising of rebirth consciousness. You know, if one is open to the possibility of rebirth, that's how it would happen. Nothing carried over, but there is an influence. There are other traditions, and as I say, even within Theravada and in Mahayana, in Zen, in Tibetan, where they talk about an unconditioned awareness that is apart from the five aggregates. Now, this is what's kind of tricky about this whole business, because that's real. I'm not a great Buddhist scholar, but I've done a fair amount, you know, of reading and studying. And in my reading of the suttas and the discourses, I don't really see that as being expressed, that consciousness apart from the aggregates. However, this teaching is coming very often from great teachers. You know, whether in Theravada or in the other traditions, of beings who certainly seem quite awakened. So then how do you hold it? You know, it's, okay, this is one view of it, This is another view of it. We can go back to the suttas and really try to see as far as we can tell, you know, well, what did the Buddha seem to say about it? But also, you know, when we're with these great teachers who really are manifesting what seem to be very enlightened qualities, and they're saying different things. So this was the dilemma. I don't know how many of you, you know, have read one of my earlier books, One Dharma. But this was the koan for me that was tormenting me. Some schools say that awareness is conditioned, just another conditioned arising and passing. And the other view is that there is an unconditioned awareness. Well, for me, you know, having kind of devoted my life to this practice, here were great beings saying opposite things about the ultimate nature of experience. And it was tormenting. You know, and I kept asking myself the question, who's right? And I was just going back and forth. I was on a 2-month retreat at the time, consumed by this question. Until finally, I was about a month into it. It was a really difficult retreat. I mean, my mind, it just couldn't let go. My mind had just chomped on to this dilemma. You know, but finally, it resolved in a very interesting way for me. First, the first big realization was that I didn't know. All I knew was that these teachers said this, and these traditions said this, and this tradition said this, and they were saying opposite things, and I didn't know. You know, and I thought, well, maybe when I'm fully enlightened, then I'll know, but right now, I don't. So I developed a little mantra for myself, who knows? Is awareness conditioned? Is it unconditioned? But what was important for me to realize or to experience was that it was not the who knows of confusion. It was the who knows of openness. That I didn't have to have an opinion about it. So this is just a little footnote and a suggestion. Look to see, or I'll talk about myself. I looked to see how many opinions I had about things I knew nothing about. And I think it's not uncommon. So that would be worth checking. You know, if you have strong opinions about anything, do we really know? Or is it just an opinion? So that was very freeing. But then my mind went one other place that really helped resolve it. The conflict of views, and I began to see, I had a little phrase for myself, metaphysics as skillful means rather than as statements of truth. You know, so in all the different Buddhist teachings and philosophy, each one has its own metaphysical understanding of the nature of the mind, the nature of the universe. There are these big metaphysical systems, and they may be different in different systems. And I had been looking at which one is right. But then that's the wrong question. When I understood each of the teachings simply as a skillful means for liberating the mind, then the only question is this teaching helping me to let go of clinging? It's not a question of the teaching being as some statement of absolute truth. Is this a skillful means? Does it help me to let go of clinging? Because that is the essence of the liberated mind. You know? So in that sense, the practice becomes very simple. And it really allows us to let go of all these questions that seem to stump us. Do you follow? Yeah. it was really helpful. And then everything relaxed. And then I realized I could hear teachings from lots of different traditions. And even if they're saying conflicting things, I can just see, is this a skillful means for me at this time to let go of grasping? If it is, fine. And if it's not, then we can let it go.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. You're welcome. I just want to build on that a little bit, because, you know, sometimes we make our practice, just the way we think about our practice and our self-assessment and self-judgment about it, and just all the thoughts we may have about our practice, we can get very complicated. You know, and the mind can get really confused. The Buddha was very clear in his teachings about the nature of freedom, the nature of liberation. And he declared it in that very famous quote, which you're probably familiar with, you know, the house builder quote after his enlightenment, where he said, "Oh, house builder of self, you have now been seen, you will build no house again. You know, the ridgepole shattered, the rafters broken." But the last line, "Realized is the unconditioned, achieved is the end of craving." The whole thing is about that. What keeps us bound on this wheel of samsara, this endless wheel of becoming, is craving. It's just is wanting in the mind. And the whole practice is about coming to the end of craving. Now, for a long time, I would put that as a far-off goal. You know, I think, oh, this is the third noble truth, the end of craving, the end of suffering. And I was thinking, yeah, maybe in 50 lifetimes I'll get there. And, you know, maybe we will get there in some complete way. But what I realized, and was so helpful for me in my practice, that can be our practice moment to moment. We can practice the end of craving in this moment and actually have that moment and experience that moment of peace. So I'll just... every question becomes an hour-long Dharma talk. But I want to share with you something that has been just really helpful for me. And it's, in a way, it changed my practice a lot. And it goes back to an understanding of the importance of the insight into impermanence. So one of the lines from that we read a lot in the suttas, and it's a line that would often enlighten people when they heard it, or it would be something that people said in the moment of their enlightenment. And so it's extremely simple. Whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. Okay, so that's just an obvious statement of impermanence. I had read it a million times. And yeah, whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. But then in one self-retreat I was doing recently, last year or so, that line came to mind right... I was sitting, and right in the middle of the meditation, I was just in the process, you know, in the flow of phenomena, just sitting, being mindful, being aware of the flow, and that line came to mind. Whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. But at that point, it wasn't an intellectual thought. It was almost as if that line dropped right into the process. Do you know what I mean? It took on a vividness. So, yeah, I'm just in this flow of changing phenomena and realizing, oh yeah, whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. And then my mind realized in that moment, therefore, there's nothing to want. Because whatever it is that we want, will also pass away. So nothing we want is going to satisfy us. Because whatever it is going to also pass away. And what was interesting in that, so just in that moment of seeing there's nothing to want, I could feel my mind from within the meditation itself drop back from any leaning into the next moment. So I don't know whether you've had that experience, but I would guess that whether you've noticed it or not, it's pretty common, right? We're with this in order for this, right? We're with this moment in order for the next moment, as if somehow the next moment is going to actually resolve everything. But of course that doesn't, and so then we lean into the next moment. So our whole practice, you could call this craving for becoming. Right? The Buddha talked about different kinds of craving for sense pleasures, craving for becoming. That's this leaning into. In that moment of saying there's nothing to want, I could feel it. And it's just maybe just a few moments, but it gives a taste of the peace and the freedom and the completion that's there in not wanting. And that's what our practice is. You know, we think our practice is to get this experience or get that experience or have, I don't know, whatever fantasies you have about your meditation practice. But the essence of the freedom is in not craving, not wanting. And now we can practice and remind ourselves every moment. Did that land? But for me, it really just brought something that I feel is absolutely fundamental back into the meditation, because I've just seen in myself and with many, many yogis, it's so easy to get caught up in meditative craving. And in a way, we justify it to ourselves because it's meditative and dharmic, and not seeing the craving aspect of it, and therefore not experiencing the peace of not wanting. There's nothing to want. Then the process is just, everything is just coming and going by itself, and there's freedom in that. So, you know, all of this is another aspect of the investigation. It's just something to investigate a little bit and explore. But this really gets to the heart of it. You know, and it reflects the Buddha's enlightenment achieved as the end of craving. Well, we can do it for a moment at a time, or 2 moments at a time. Okay. Okay. All the way in the back. Where's Greg? First one, then the other.
My question has to do with unpleasant mind states and these creatures that come to visit. And the ones that I don't like, the unpleasant states, the ones that I'm here to help alleviate, when noticed, even though I invite them in for tea, like, they hear Admiral Akbar say, it's a trap, retreat. And I think what it is that I'm afraid of, there'll be no witness to my story. And that, I mean, I'm an only child and a long story, and I've suffered, you know, and it's been solitary a lot. And there's a lot of pain there. And And my whole life, it's been, I mean, what about me? And now it's like, and now it's sort of like there's this baby Buddha, Buddha nature, you know, what about me? And I'm so afraid to let go of that story. And I feel like I'm almost betraying myself if I let go of it. And I've had moments where I've let go of the story and, you know, I'm soaring and it's awesome. But like, then the pain, like, and the pain disappears and then, you know, but...
Oh, pain, come back. So I know I'm here.
Well, not only that, sir, but also, like, you know, terms like spiritual bypassing and, like, you know, this trauma, it's stored in the body, and it just, you know, if I let go of the story, that pain, is that pain still there?
Yeah.
And then so, I'm mental, but, so thank you.
So this is kind of interweaving, I think, two levels of investigation. One level is the psychological level, which really has to do with our story and the content and the feelings associated with it. And the other level, you could say, is the meditative level, where we're seeing the emptiness and the impermanence of it all. And there's an overlap. They're not identical, but there is some area of overlap of those two. So when people are practicing, a lot of psychological content does come up, you know, from our past history and our childhood and different, the emotional patterns. And for some time, it is important and helpful really to make space for that to be there and to feel it and to be with it and to open to all of that conditioning. But at a certain point, you know, when we have seen the same thing 10,000 times, and we're really not learning anything new, then it's not a question of spiritual bypass at that point. We have been in it, we've understood it, we've investigated it, we've looked at it, we've explored it. At a certain point, then it is totally appropriate to see getting lost in this again or holding on to it or identifying with it is not serving in any way. I'm not learning anything new from this. This is just an old pattern. At that point, I think you need to be quite precise about noting that thought. Oh, well, what would happen if I let go of it? Because it's a thought like that which is seducing you back into the story. If you're not mindful that that thought is just a thought arising and passing, you don't have to act on it. You don't have to do anything about it. You don't have to believe it. Right? It's just a thought arising in the mind. That, by being very precise about the thought pattern that brings you back into the story at that point, if you can see the trigger thought that leads you back into it and are mindful of it and note it, that thought can come and go, and you're still in the freedom of not being identified with the story. So I don't know, you know, you might discuss with your teachers, you know, and in discussion really feel out, okay, is this just old psychological history that I've really explored and can let go of at this point, or not? You know, and see where you are in that trajectory. But there's definitely a point where there's just no need. There's nothing productive happening in staying lost in the story. So just something I've mentioned a lot in my teachings. This goes back many years, but I was working with a lot of fear. And I had built up a whole self story about being this fearful person, and oh my God, it's going to take 30 years of therapy, and you know, on and on and on. And then realizing I was building a whole superstructure of self on top of a momentary arising emotion. Fear's there. It's conditioned by whatever, you know, causes and conditions were there for it to arise. But I didn't have to take it on as being self, as being I. It's just a mind state. And the mind state itself is impermanent and not self. And so when I could unhook from my attachment to the story, then it all just, it flowed through. And it doesn't mean, and this may be addressed one of your fears or apprehensions, it didn't mean that fear never arose again. It can arise at different times, but my whole relationship to it has changed. Instead of believing that this is me and this is who I am, it's like a sound. You know, some sounds are pleasant, some sounds are unpleasant, some are bigger, some are softer. But it's just a sound coming and going. It's just a mind state coming and going. So I hope that addressed it in some way. There was one other. Yeah.
excuse me. I was just wanting to revisit the investigation that you were talking about a little while ago. I've heard the teaching of sort of looking for what's knowing a number of times, and it always kind of makes my head want to explode. because I don't understand how to look for what's knowing. Is it as simple as just asking the question, what's knowing? Or is there more to the process? And actually, as I'm asking you this, I realize I'm grasping for some certainty that probably isn't even really there. But is there more to that process?
Not really.
Okay, good.
And I would just play with it. All of these suggestions, play. You know, have fun. It's just, instead of thinking there's a right way and a wrong way to do it, just, the mind is a completely fascinating phenomenon. You know, and our whole life is the manifestation of what's going on in our minds. You know, and all the suffering in the world. What is all that about? It's just the manifestation of greed and hatred and fear. And everything's the manifestation of people's minds. So it's this completely fascinating exploration. Right? So I would really suggest you have fun doing it. You know, it's... Without feeling, oh yeah, am I doing it right? No, so you hold the question, well, what's knowing it? I don't know. You look this way, you look that way, you don't do anything. And just, you know, you could almost plant the question as a seed and then just see what comes out of it.
There's no recipe, or I don't need a flashlight or something. And then the other...
The recipe is have fun.
Well, then the difficulty with the having fun part is that it seems...
Sometimes it's not fun.
Yeah. It seems to me that... My feeling or experience is that especially intense, difficult emotional and mind states impede the ability to even ask what's knowing in the moment, even when I'm mindful of the state itself.
Okay, so then that's not the right question then at that time. If one of the things that I've learned over these many years of practice is that when my mind is suffering, you know, caught up in, and over the years at different times, just like all of you, there can be a lot of suffering, you know, around different situations and issues. But over these years, I've really... it piques my interest. So it may not be the question who's knowing, but, you know, in the midst of that suffering, what is going on? What is my mind doing that's creating the suffering? How am I relating to what's happening that's creating the suffering? So the suffering itself becomes the impetus for investigation. You know, and because if we're suffering, there's some reason, there's some cause, there's something our mind is doing that's creating the suffering. You know, what are we holding on to? What are we pushing away? What are we not open to? So we just look, you know, and you use the very intensity of the situation. It can really provoke a lot of interest and inquiry.
Oh, sorry.
It's all good. Next.
Sometimes between hindrance attacks, I get this feeling like I have so much to wake up to in this life, and especially like all the ignorance surrounding, you know, all the privileges of my life, you know, especially for me, like whiteness and able-bodiedness and, you know, material family members and material wealth. And so I guess, like, as inspiration, how is, you know, that kind of, you know, waking up to, Brian said, the weight of that, what has that looked like for you in your practice?
Mm-hmm. So that has been a really big part, especially, and I don't know how much it's been talked about here, but, you know, it's over the last 10 years or so, IMS as an institution and teaching, we've been doing a lot of work in that arena of undoing racism and understanding that, and just the many aspects of different kinds of diversity and opening to understanding it. And it is it's a huge, very enriching. I've just found it both eye-opening and completely enriching, both of my life and of my Dharma practice, to begin to see just the many things you mentioned. In that process, I think it really engenders both compassion and understanding for people who are marginalized in some way in our society, you know, and the suffering involved in that. And opening to that is really an extension of opening to the Four Noble Truths, to see the truth of suffering and its causes in an external way, not only within ourselves. So there's something very uplifting and enriching and opening about just exploring these areas that may have been overlooked or unconscious. And I saw that in myself for many years, just not basically being oblivious to it. So that's one side. It's like being willing to get past the comfort zone of our life, you know, and to be exploring these issues. But it's not a question of feeling, and I think it's not helpful and it's not appropriate to have that engender feelings of guilt or self-judgment or, you know, going that route, because that doesn't help anything. That's just more unwholesome mind states. So my experience is that the more one feels gratitude, and, you know, tomorrow's Thanksgiving, and I'm going to the big family Thanksgiving dinner, and every year there's a little, you know, go around talking about gratitude. But this year, in thinking about going, I realized that gratitude for the many blessings in our lives, which we all share in many, that's only half of it. And it was really realizing for me that the manifestation of gratitude is not just appreciating, you know, the many blessings in our lives, but the extension of that in generosity. And I really began to see the connection between gratitude and generosity. You know, and so then when we do find ourselves in a state of blessing, where there is abundance of one kind or another, and it might be material, it might be emotional, you know, it might be just not understanding, when we feel the gratitude for any kind of abundance in our lives, that then can become the motivation and the impetus to cultivate and to practice generosity, you know, as an expression of that. And so that's beautiful. Then the whole, this whole enlarged understanding, you know, of our particular conditioning in relationship to society, it starts to spill out, you know, in our willingness to share, to give, to offer. And so that becomes a beautiful spiral. The more we open to the suffering that's there in the world, you know, with an open heart, the more compassion arises out of the compassion, and then gratitude for our own situation. Then comes generosity and giving, and so it just becomes a spiral that benefits everyone. So that's how I see it. It's a very important arena of practice. But I would just be careful about, as you open to, you might say, the unearned privilege that comes in many forms, it's important to see that and to realize that. But it's, in my way, in my understanding, that need not be the cause of a heaviness. It's sort of an awakening, an enlightening, that then can manifest in really beautiful ways. That understanding. You know. The practice of generosity, the Buddha often began his teachings, the graduated teachings, he would often begin with teachings on generosity, because it's just such a beautiful, joyful quality. You know, and we can practice that, and it's something I may have mentioned in part one, but this is just a practice of generosity that I've been trying to cultivate over many years, and I found it's really one of the most beautiful practices I do, you know, in terms of worldly Dharma practice, that when I have the thought to give something, to do it, instead of having the thought come and go and either just let it pass by or second guess ourselves or no, you know, I won't do it. If I have a thought, and it could be anything, it could be giving something material, it could be giving time, energy, attention, care, and it can take many forms. But if the thought arises, I try to do it. And it's just beautiful. And it made me realize how often I would let those thoughts go by. You know, but in undertaking this practice, it really has made it a practice in my life and been the source of a tremendous amount of happiness. Okay, gang. I could go on and on, but when one of my first teachers, Munindraji, he once gave a 3-hour talk on 21 kinds of silence. I wanted to throttle him. We were just sitting, this was in India, and the first hour was really interesting. The first hour and a half, it was interesting. 2 hours, 2.5 hours, legs were killing me. So we vowed not to do that. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.